Welcome back. Here's our next story from today's Des Moines Register. And we will start with the sports section. Pictured on the front here is Waukee's Angelina Carter Center and Jaina Marhare exchanging the baton during the 800-meter sprint medley relay on Friday at the Drake Relays, with rain all over the track and people wearing their raincoats. Waukee 800-meter sprint medley team boosted by youngsters at Drake Relays. At the 2024 Drake Relays, the high school girls' 800-meter sprint medley was always set to be a barn burner. The top three times on the year coming into the annual event at the Blue Oval were separated by less than a second, with Johnston leading the way with a time of 1:46.80 at the 2024 Jim Duncan Invite, just 13 days before the relays. And pictured on page 3 is high school athletes take center stage at Drake Relays on Friday. And with the baton, ADM's Brevin Dahl, 132, anchors his team's 4x200 victory at the Drake Relays on Friday. Other members of the team were Aiden Flora, Grant Richonsky, and Zach Lokeman. They finished in 1:27.34. Pictured below that, Waukee's Northwest Avery Winter celebrates her team's victory in the girls' 4x200 at the Drake Relays on Friday. Other members of the team were Arissa Robinson, Kenzia Caldwell, and Katie Stahl. They finished in 1:40.46. And Winter has a smile on her face. Western Dubuque's Quinton Newman wins the 800-meter run Friday at the Drake Relays. The sophomore finished in 1:52.22, and Nauman has a look of surprise and excitement on his face. Cedar Rapids Prairie's Jackson Dohanes celebrates after winning the 400-meter run Friday at the Drake Relays. The senior finished in 47.67, wearing a checkered jersey. And West Des Moines Valley's Emma Havinghurst won the 100-meter hurdles Friday at the Drake Relays. She finished in 14.67 seconds, and she has a smile on her face running from the stands to the stadium. And continuing with other sports related to the Drake Relays, Clear Lake's Broly setting the standard in several events. When Clear Lake junior Reese Broly was just a freshman in 2022, she reached the qualifying times for 400-meter freshman division and the emerging elite high school division for long jump at Nike Outdoor Nationals. It's quite an accomplishment to be able to head to Eugene, Oregon to compete against the nation's best high schoolers. Just three girls in the state of Iowa, one being Brownlee, would have met the qualifying standards for the 2024 Nike Outdoor Nationals in the long jump based on competition so far this season. When Brownlee went, she took fourth place in the high school division with a leap of 17 feet 8 3/4 inches. In the 400-meter dash, she took first in the freshman division with a time of 56.5 seconds. It was there she announced to the track and field world that she would be an elite talent, But if you ask Brownlee, all she remembers is the beautiful Hayward Field facility, the large track, the tower in the backdrop, and the sights of anything and everything being the color green. The accomplishment of getting there, let alone how she finished, is often an afterthought to her. Honestly, I don't think I know any new... Honestly, I don't think I knew any better, Brownlee said. Despite qualifying for the Nike event again on different occasions in different events, Brownlee hasn't gone back, focusing instead on her success here in Iowa. She's done a pretty good job at that, according to athletic.net, holding Clear Lake school record in the 200-meter dash, 400-meter hurdles, 4x100-meter relay, 4x800-meter relay, and long jump. She also has won two state championships, winning the Class 2A long jump title as a freshman and taking the 400-meter dash title in a Class 3A as a sophomore. In short, there isn't a ton Brownlee hasn't accomplished on the track and field scene except for winning an event at the Drake Relays. The relays being the best of the best event, and not just the best of the class like the state track meet, is a title Brownlee is aiming for since her freshman year. She took fifth in long jump in her first outing in the Blue Oval and was runner-up in 2023, keeping her inches away from getting the coveted white champion's flag. Getting a white flag, that's like what every kid in Iowa wants to get, Brownlee said. On Iowa afternoon, Brownlee finally broke through for that goal, jumping 18 feet, 3.434 inches to capture the white flag. There's still more in that tank for the state meet next month, too, since she's already posted a jump of over 19 feet earlier this season. It gave me the confidence of... I am one of the best girls in the state, and I can do this, Brownlee said. From there, she had two more events, the 400-meter dash and the 400-meter hurdles. She took second in the 400-meter dash, according to running a 55.93, less than half a second behind Waukee's Angela Carter's Drake Relay record time of 55.45. Even though Brownlee took second, she was thrilled to compete with top-tier talent. I'm almost glad that she was leading, Brownlee said. Now I know that I can run in high 55s, and when it comes to next month of May, I know I can run low 55s and PR. Even better, I was alone out there. In the end, I probably still would have been in the 56s. On Saturday afternoon, Brownlee capped off her relays with the 400-meter hurdle. She claimed another white flag with the time of 1 minute and 0.75, another personal record for the Clear Lake Junior. The fact that I got a PR in two out of my three events this weekend, that's more than I could have imagined for this weekend, Brownlee said. She'll take a moment to celebrate breaking through on her dream, planning on visiting Drake and Buster's with her brother and devouring some chicken before turning her attention to winning what could be multiple state titles next month. May is what matters, Brownlee said. No matter how fun this is, May is what matters.
Okay, I'll try to get us out of the sports section here with a little bit. Actually, some basketball news. Three former Iowa players land in other programs. Three former Iowa men's basketball players have found homes in other programs after entering the transfer portal. Arguably, the biggest loss for Iowa was Tony Perkins, who was a member of last season's All-Big Ten second team, as voted by coaches. The 2023-24 campaign was the most productive of Perkins' college career, averaging 14 points, 4.6 assists, and 4.4 rebounds per game. Perkins scored more than 1,100 points combined across four seasons with the Hawkeyes. After entering the transfer portal, Perkins has since signed with Missouri, where he's set to play for head coach Dennis Gates. Perkins has one season of college eligibility remaining. Tony is a complete player and a place and a piece that fills an essential position for our program, Gates said in a release. He continued, he brings great size and physicality for his position, while his experience running a power conference program will translate quickly at Mizzou and in the SEC. He is a multifaceted player who can score, distribute, and rebound while playing exceptional defense on the other end. What separates him is his toughness and unselfishness, epitomizing our eight core values. Patrick McCaffrey, son of Hawkeye head coach Fran McCaffrey, also entered the transfer portal following the conclusion of Iowa's season. Patrick McCaffrey, who was a member of a Big Ten tournament championship team, along with Perkins, had been a part of the Hawkeye program since 2019. Patrick also went over the 1,000-point mark in his Iowa career. Playing for my dad was not always easy. It's a tricky situation, Patrick McCaffrey told the Register's Chad Leistikow. He continued, I loved every minute of it, but it'll be good to play for somebody else and have a different set of pressures. When you're the coach's kid, you constantly feel like you have to prove yourself to everybody, close quote. Patrick McCaffrey, who has one season of college eligibility remaining, signed with Butler in April and is set to play for head coach Thad Matta. Matta said, Patrick has played in multiple NCAA tournaments and is really high-level games in the Big Ten. That experience will serve our program well over the next season. He continued, he brings a high basketball IQ and has obviously been well coached. As we build our program, players and leaders like Patrick are exactly what we need. Close quote. Most recently, Iowa transfer DeSante Brown committed to St. Bonaventure, according to ESPN's Jonathan Givony. Bowen, a native of Massachusetts who played prep ball at Brewster Academy in New Hampshire, is returning to the Northeast. After playing sparingly as a freshman, Bowen started Iowa's first eight games last season, but Bowen fell out of the starting lineup and saw a decreased role before missing the latter stages of the season due to a knee injury. DeSante Bowen is one of the finest people I've ever coached in 41 years, Fan McCaffrey said in March. And he continued, and I would do whatever I can to help him find a place that works for him. He's one of my favorite ever, close quote. While that trio is departing the program via the transfer portal, Iowa also lost a fourth scholarship player, Ben Cricke, who exhausted his college eligibility. The Hawkeyes have been active in the transfer portal to fill some of those gaps. Iowa landed Morehead State transfer Drew Thelwell, who averaged 10 points and 6.2 assists per game last season on a team that went to the NCAA tournament. One of the biggest dominoes of Iowa's offseason, though, is still to be determined. Peyton Sanford declared for the 2024 NBA draft while maintaining his college eligibility. He has until May 29th to decide his future plans. Iowa's roster for the 2024-25 season continues to take shape as the offseason rolls on. A real quick little blurb, also related to basketball. Extreme Arena to host the 2026 Missouri Valley Conference Women's Championship. On Thursday, the Missouri Valley Conference announced that Extreme Arena in Coralville would host the 2026 MVC Women's Basketball Tournament. It will mark the first time that the tournament will be held in Coralville. Over the next three seasons, the tournament will be held at Ford Center in Evansville, Indiana, and Extreme Arena and Vibrant Arena at the Mark in Moline. That's in 27. We're excited about developing new relationships and growing the sport of women's basketball in the region, said MVC Commissioner Jeff Jackson. The championship coalition, or the championship rotation model, includes three great venues and three great communities who share the conference's goal of prioritizing women's basketball, close quote. All 12 MVC teams will compete in the four-day tournament, with the winner earning an automatic spot in the NCAA tournament. The previous two hosting sites were the Mark and the Family Arena in St. Charles, Missouri. We are thrilled to continue to provide our women's basketball student-athletes with the opportunity to be showcased in a neutral site standalone tournament, said Valparaiso President Jose D. Padilla, chair of the board of directors of the MVC. The next 3 years, he continued, the next 3 years will give us the opportunity to grow the Missouri Valley Conference's national brand through visibility in new communities while affording affording our student athletes the chance to experience new conference tournament venues. The tournament will take place from March 12th through the 15th in 2026. Back to you, Nicholas.
Why 2025 NFL Draft could set records for Iowa football. 12 months can be a football eternity, but as things currently stand, the 2025 NFL Draft has the potential to be record-setting for the Iowa Hawkeyes. Since the NFL Draft was condensed in its current 7-round format in 1994, the most Hawkeyes selected in one draft is 6. That happened 3 times in succession with the 2010, 2011, and 2012 drafts. Only once since 2012 have that Hawkeyes only once since 2012 have that Hawkeyes seen as many as 5 players chosen. And that happened in 2020 with late assist from 7th rounders Geno Stone and Nate Stanley. But in 2025, Iowa has the potential to have 12 NFL draft picks. 12. Sure, it would take a perfect storm of development and success to reach that number, but the 2025 NFL draft is expected to be incredibly deep, which could push from traditional 5th and 6th rounds picks in some years completely out of the draft. But it's easy to envision a scenario in which the Hawkeyes set a program's record with 7 or more picks. The decision by so many current players to take advantage of their bonus COVID-19 season of eligibility and return to Iowa for one last ride in 2024 helped create this reality. My apologies. Helped create this reality. So let's look ahead to Iowa's potential in the April 24 to 26, 2025 NFL Draft, which will be held at Titledown, the home of the Green Bay Packers. The potential, probable first rounder, Luke Lakey. Even with defensive back Cooper DeJean missing out of Thursday's first round, Iowa still has now delivered 6 first-round selections over the past 6 NFL drafts. That list includes T.J. Hockenson, number 8 from 2019, Noah Font, number 20 from 2019, Tristan Wirfs, number 13 from 2020, Tyler Lindenbaum, 25 from 2022, and Lucas Van Ness, number 13 from 2023. And Jack Campbell, number 18 from 2023. Of note, tight end Sam Laporta, number 34 in 2023, just missed first-round status, and considering how Laporta played like a first-rounder as a rookie for the Detroit Lions, and Lakey has even better measurables at 6'6", 253 pounds, as the tight end position, the Hawkeyes' best offensive player has a great chance to be the program's next first rounder. Lakey has already seen potentially a top tight end in the 2025 class with Michigan's Colston Loveland right there with him. They could stage quite a battle for the first team all Big Ten status and to be the first tight end of the board next April. The definite guys on defense, Yahya Black, Sebastian Castro, and Jay Higgins. One of the most underrated decisions that occurred, one that got zero attention, was Black telling his coaches that he would return for the 5th year senior season. Because it wasn't a COVID year and Black had solid but unspectacular production last season, 51 tackles, 5 tackles for loss, folks just assumed he'd be back, but he had a real decision to make, and by returning, Black, 6-5 and 315, could be minimum become a day 2 pick in 2025. Castro, 5-10, 205, also would have been drafted this year, so he'll most definitely be a mid-round pick in 2025 at worst. Truth be told, Castro deserved the Big Ten Defensive Back of the Year award as much as winner DeJuan did. In 2023, Castro was a game wrecker and a playmaker from Iowa's pivotal cash position, which translates great to the pass-happy NFL. Castro's pick six at Iowa State keyed that 2013 Iowa win, and his thumping hits in Iowa's 15-6 win at Wisconsin will be seen on NFL draft cut-ups over the next year. Higgins, 6-2, 233, will be pure production linebacker at the next level, similar in a lot of ways to former Hawkeye Butkus Award finalist Josie Jewell. Higgins' toughness, durability, and leadership combined with the relentless tackling ability. Higgins, 171 stops in 2023, tied Andre Jackson's single-season school record, will be plenty to make him a mid-round pick at minimum. Colby, 6-6, 313 pounds, will have been a four-year college starter if all goes well in 2024 and is the highest-ranked Iowa offensive lineman ahead of the 2025 draft. Colby's permanent move inside to guard will prove to be a blessing for his NFL draft stock. Colby is rated the number 35 overall offensive line prospect in early rankings by NFLDraftBuzz.com, putting him in the day three conversation. Jones, 6'3", 290, has the potential to significantly increase his draft stock. This season, the converted defensive lineman has followed the path of Linderbaum, even down to the jersey number, but hasn't yet delivered the type of performance that made Linderbaum a Remingham Trophy winner, a first-round pick, and Pro Bowler for the Baltimore Ravens. His injuries have slowed Jones' progression, but he has the lower body strength and speed/agility that NFL teams want at center. If Jones doesn't have the year he wants, he has the option to return to his six-year senior season at Iowa. Richmond, 6-6, 312, is in line to be a four-year starting left tackle at Iowa, but probably projects the guard in the NFL. Like Jones, Richmond played hurt throughout much of 2023 season and has the potential to become a late-round draft pick. Expect at least one of those offensive linemen to get drafted in 2025 and possibly all three. Three defenders on the fence, Deontay Craig, Jeremiah Harris, and Nick Jackson. Craig, 6-3, 266, can follow a long line of Hawkeye defensive linemen who emerged in their fourth or fifth year to become a mid-round draft pick. Past examples include Mike Daniels, fourth round in 2012, and Carl Davis, third round in 2015, Jaleel Johnson, fourth round in 2017, Anthony Nelson, fourth round in 2019, Chauncey Golston, third round in 2021, and Davion Nixon, fifth round in 2021. Craig was banged up as a redshirt junior, but with a good year of health as the tools in production, 11 career sacks, to be the draft conversation. When he's on the field, Harris, 6'1", 190, has shown he has the size and production to be a top-shelf cornerback. Staying healthy has been a challenge, though, and he'll need an all-Big Ten kind of season to be in the 2025 draft mix. Jackson, 6'0", and 237, has already proven to be durable, productive linebacker and will enter next year's draft good, healthy, willing, with more than 70 college games of experience at the age of 24. Jackson could become a seventh-round pick for the team that values reliability over flash. two juniors with decisions to make, Aaron Graves, Xavier Nwamka. Two of the most physically gifted recruits of the Kirk Ferentz era, Graves 6'4", 293 at defensive tackle, and Nwamka 6'2", at 210 at safety, entered the class of 2022 and will have the opportunity to depart the program after 3 years. Both in-state prospects seem wired in selfless ways and both need further development to make the next steps to the next level. Van Ness and Dijon were two prime examples of Hawkeyes who had more untapped college potential but had the physical prowess to jump into the NFL draft's first round after 3 years at Iowa. Neither Graves nor Nwamka necessarily locked down a premium NFL position, so they might benefit from staying the fourth year in college ball, but their junior years are certainly worth watching, especially for NFL scouts. So, will Iowa actually get 12 draft picks? Probably not, and there could even be a surprise addition to this list. Maybe a transfer or a surprise breakout performer, say running back Caleb Johnson or right tackle Glennings Dunker. But seeing this collection of names underscores that the Hawkeyes' 2024 football season does have the potential to be something special, which, for them, could lead to a record-setting 2025 NFL draft.
Okay, let's get out of the weeds of sports. The business section, developer expands plans for old Highland apartment site. Euclid Avenue project will now have 100 units. In a sign of the growing popularity of Des Moines' Highland Park neighborhood and the development group chosen to build the replacement for Landmark apartment building, says it's more than doubling the number of units it plans to build. The four-story mixed-use structure Invest DSM has chosen Sonar development partners to build on the former site of the Highland Apartments, will now have 100 units, up from 40 to 50 studio, one- and two-bedroom apartments in the original plan. The building it will replace had just 12. The building, to be called the Commons, will also have a restaurant and retail space. It will be built on the southwest corner of 6th and Euclid Avenues in the neighborhood's rapidly revitalizing business district. Sonar Development founder Brian Clark said the decision to expand the plan came as they looked to balance the financial requirements needed to make this project go forward with the needs of the neighborhood. He continues, "So we have an increased density to 100 units while still maintaining a scale that's appropriate and providing building materials that respect the context of Highland Park," he said. Christopher Civitate, Invest DSM's development manager, said that the group will meet with neighbors later this spring to present more information on the project and garner feedback. He said there's still room for them to have input and make changes then. Some Highland Park area residents, objected strongly to the demolition last September of the old building, vacant since 2018, despite the conclusion of Invest DSM and developers that the cost of dealing with severe water damage from a leaking roof would make restoration of the more than century-old structure unfeasible. Work is slated to start in 2025. After the commons is complete, Sonar will own and manage the building. The firm is also the project manager for Total Health Experience, a $250 million medical campus planned in Urbandale. Once completed, the commons will offer a mix of affordable and market-rate units, helping address a growing challenge in the neighborhood, while it has seen a slew of businesses open in recent months. Highland Park is lacking in housing affordable for its workforce. The commons will join smaller projects seeking to close the gap, including an effort to turn the upper level of the former Klein's department store on 6th Avenue into apartments affordable to tenants earning 60% or less of the area median income, or $57,120 for a family of four. I'm excited to play a part in continuing the momentum building in this area, Clark said. Our goal is to provide much-needed housing that complements the character of the area and honors the history of the site and neighborhood. And then I'm going to jump over to a piece in the national news about protesting that's going on this spring about the Arab situation, the Palestinian situation. Columbia protests. Before students set up a protest encampment on a Columbia University lawn earlier this month, some of them took to an optional course called Columbia 1968 about protests against the Vietnam War, a similarly galvanizing moment of campus activism. Frank Gurady, the Columbia history professor who has taught the class since 2017, along with a couple of his students, stopped by the encampment of the New York City campus on Thursday to discuss the parallels at a teach-in called 1968, Continuing the Fight. Protesters listened, sitting on mats in the grass outside their tents, eating free kidney beans and rice and kosher Passover snacks off paper plates from a nearby community kitchen set up on tables under canopies. The school administration suspended the dozens of protesting students and had them arrested earlier this month. Some of them say they are only acting on the lessons and education they've received on campus as they oppose Israel's war in Gaza. Bo Tang, a second-year undergraduate history student, said he was part of the student protesters' research group, which looked at the strategies and tactics of past and present social justice movements to, quote, try to take lessons from them, close quote. The group interviewed alumni involved in the 1968 protests, some found through Gurdy's class, Tang said, getting them to share lessons on building support for a protest movement. Tang and other students say classmates and professors previously agnostic about the protest showed up at the encampment after police were called in, including faculty who have donned yellow vests to help with security and safety. Protest encampments have also appeared at colleges across the U.S. and abroad in solidarity with the Columbia students, drawing criticism from the White House, many Republican lawmakers, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who called the protesters anti-Semitic and intimidating to Jewish students. Many Jewish students are among the organizers, though, and bristle at allegations of anti-Semitism. Over many hours spent at the encampment last week, Reuters journalists have seen students peacefully chatting, reading, eating, and holding both Jewish and Muslim prayer ceremonies. There have been jazz performances, lectures, first aid courses, bouts of pro-Palestinian revolutionary chants, and writing workshops. Sometimes heated but nonviolent debates break out between anti-Zionist Jews and pro-Israel students visiting the camp. A typical sign, excuse me, warns those in the encampment, however, to be careful in their interactions with counter-protesters. We do not engage with instigators. Liberated Zone. The student protesters set up the encampment at dawn on April 17th without required school permission, demanding, excuse me while I change the pages. This takes a minute. It's all these numbers. Columbia divest from weapons manufacturers and other companies that support Israel's government and military. The protests, held in coalition with dozens of other student groups, have been led by Columbia chapters of Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace, both of which the school suspended in November for an earlier unauthorized pro-Palestinian protest. The day after the encampment was set up, Columbia President Menoshe Shefik called the police, who arrested 106 of the students on trespassing charges, outraging some faculty. Students have since rebuilt the encampment, more bustling than before. Shafik, who declined interviews to request through a spokesman, has said she called police as a last resort for rule-breaking, that the encampment has caused rancor on campus, and that school policy cannot be dictated by a subset of students and staff. Her administration has been holding stop-and-start negotiations with the protesting students while steadily filling adjoining lawns with bleachers and scaffolding ahead of the school's May 15th commencement ceremony. "We have our demands. They have theirs," she wrote in a campus-wide email. At his teach-in, Gertie and his students told the protesters how their 1968 predecessors were outraged by Columbia disciplining six students who had protested the school's ties to weapons research and the university plans to build a racially segregated gym near Harlem. The 1968 protesters occupied multiple buildings on campus and held the acting dean hostage for a day before police violently ended the occupation a week later, arresting some 700 students. The 2024 protesters decided to instead occupy one lawn of the main Columbia campus, noting that school administrators recently designated it for protests, albeit with permission. Marianne Alwan, a third-year Palestinian-American undergraduate student among those arrested and suspended earlier this month, said the easily circumvented hedge-lined lawn was chosen so administrators could not accuse them of disrupting classes. "We looked at some of the imagery of the 68 protests," Alwan said. A famous photograph of the 68 protests shows student holding a large sign saying, "Liberated Zone." The 2024 protesters erected a similar sign over their camp, and Alwan was delighted to see the sign since spread to other campuses. "My class is not a boot camp for revolution," Gertie said in an interview after his teach-in. "It's a history class." He called Tang one of his sharpest students. Around protest, Tang still has to finish his final paper for Gertie's Columbia 1968 class. "It's hard to get A pluses in the humanities classes," Tang said, "but I'm shooting for it." Back to you, Nicholas.
Lawsuit accuses Target of collecting biometric data. An Illinois woman has filed a lawsuit accusing Target of illegally collecting and storing her and others' customers' biometric data through facial recognition technology and other means without their consent. The lawsuit, filed March 11 in a Cook County Circuit Court and published by local outlet Fox 32, alleges the Target's surveillance systems covertly collect things like face and fingerprint scans from customers as part of its anti-theft efforts. The alleged practice violates Illinois Biometric Information Privacy Act. The lawsuit contends a law the state legislature passed in 2008 to protect people from details of their physical characteristics being collected without their knowledge. Target does not notify customers of this fact prior to store entry, nor does it obtain consent prior to collecting its customers' biometric data, according to the lawsuit. Target did not immediately respond Tuesday morning to USA Today's request for comment. Biometric information comprises data on a range of a person's physical characteristics, including retina or iris scans, fingerprints, voice prints, hand scans, facial geometry, and DNA. Illinois Biometric Privacy Act, better known as BIPA, makes it unlawful for private companies to use facial recognition technology to identify and track such information without people's consent, according to the state's American Civil Liberties Union. The law also requires companies to specify how the information would be retained and when it would be destroyed. In 2022, the social media app Snapchat was sued over an alleged violation of BIPA, performing to the data collecting from users who used features like lenses and filters to take photos and videos of themselves. The company ultimately agreed to a $35 million settlement, according to the Rockford Register-Star, a USA Today network publication. In a newer suit against Target, attorneys argued that the retailer giant's stores across the country are outfitted with cameras and video surveillance, many of which have the capacity of collecting biometric data. While the system is meant to deter shoplifters, the lawsuit contended that it captures any customer's face who enters the store. There are numerous instances of former Target employees detailing its facial recognition system circulating on the internet as well, the lawsuit said, referencing a TikTok page where customers and ex-employees discuss concerns about the system. Target is far from the first major American company to face legal action due to concerns over its biometric data collection practices. Last year, Amazon was hit with a class action lawsuit accusing the company of failing to properly inform New York City customers of biometric information collection in Amazon Go stores. Amazon confirmed to USA Today that it used biometric data for its Amazon One Palm-based identity payment system, but denied using facial recognition technology in any of its stores.
All right. Staying on the business section, FTC ban on non-compete agreements. What now? A ruling by the Federal Trade Commission banning non-compete agreements as a condition of employment is getting mixed reviews from organized labor and business interests, which sued Wednesday to block it from taking effect. Whatever the outcome, it may have very little impact in Iowa, according to a Des Moines attorney who specializes in non-compete agreement cases. The agreements generally signed as part of employment contracts typically forbid workers who leave a job from going immediately to work for one of their former employer's competitors. Democrats and organized labor hailed the FTC's Tuesday decision, saying non-compete agreements restrict workers' opportunities and can infringe on other fundamental rights by blocking them from changing jobs. Non-compete agreements keep workers trapped from finding better opportunities, can force workers to move to stay in their industry, and can come with large penalties, said Peter Hurd, Secretary Treasurer of the Iowa Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO. He continued, nationally and locally, Democrats and Republicans have seen this as a problem and proposed legislation. This is not a partisan issue, and we are thankful for the Federal Trade Commission's work on this rule. Republicans on the FTC, which approved the measure on a 3-2 party line vote, said the commission overstepped its bounds with the ban, acting as though it was a legislature making a new law rather than a regulator determining how existing rules should be enforced. Mike Ralston, president of the Iowa Association of Business and Industry, concurred, saying the FTC's ruling banning non-compete agreements seems like an overreach to me. I think it's dangerous for the commission to be making a law that affects what has been standard practice, close quote. But the lack of legislative action on non-compete agreements is kind of the point, according to Charlie Whitmack, a Des Moines attorney who represents clients challenging non-compete agreements. He said, non-compete agreements are a creation of employers, and it's not a creation of the legislature. Whitmack continued, the legislature didn't create the right for employees to create non-compete agreements. Employers came up with this concept, and because employers came up with it, the courts had to determine if they were fair and legal. He said over the years, about 40 cases regarding non-compete agreements have made it to the Iowa Supreme Court, with the justices splitting 50-50 on their decisions about whether the requirements were enforceable. In Iowa, the cases where the Iowa Supreme Court has enforced non-compete assignments, there is always some underlying independent legal theory. These cases are very, very, very fact-specific, he said. Whitmack said there are three primary kinds of non-compete cases in Iowa. Those where an employer has put an employee in a situation of trust and confidence with a client and does not want the employee, after departing, to take the relationship to the competitor. Another one is recent trade cases where employees have sensitive information learned through their employment. The Iowa Supreme Court has ruled that employers are unlikely to go to another job. Employees are unlikely to go to another job and not use information they gained under a previous employer, Whitmack said. And the final is training cases where employers have paid for employees to earn a license or certificate that is related to the performance of their jobs. Whitmack said the Iowa Supreme Court has held that it would be unfair for an employee to take the benefit of that training to a competitor if the company that paid for it. Whitmark said all three scenarios restrictions an employee would likely still be enforceable after the FTC rule goes into effect because other laws apply. For instance, the cases involving an employee taking a customer relationship or a trade secret to a competitor would still be subject to the Iowa Trade Secrets Act, and the case where an employee takes up a competitor's skills learned at the previous employer's expense could be viewed as a breach of contract, especially in exchange for the training the employee had agreed to remain with the employer for a certain period. In Iowa, my legal opinion is that not much is going to change after the FTC rule goes into effect because the Iowa Supreme Court has been addressing non-compete agreements in a very fair way for a long time, requiring the agreements to be based on existing Iowa law, Whitmack said. Moving forward, employers are likely to drop non-compete agreements and instead turn to employment contracts that address trade secrets, customer relationships, and training, he said. And that's pretty much that story, Nicholas. I'm going to let that go because it goes on and we're going to run out of time.
Yeah, we have about time for one more article. This is out of the Iowa in Life section, three memorial moments from Zach Bryan's Des Moines concert. Hey, Iowa concert goers, Zach Bryan hopes you don't hate this song. His song. No, it's not brand new. In fact, it's one of his earlier songs called Condemned. Well, the crowd sang it alongside Bryan, so it's probably safe to assume they like it. Bryan mentioned that before several songs throughout his show in Des Moines on April 25th, an entirely unnecessary line when you consider he's a Grammy winner, an Academy of Country Music Award winner, and a musician who had two back-to-back shows in the Wells Fargo Arena that kicked off Thursday night. Donning an Iowa Hawkeyes athletic t-shirt throughout the entire night, Bryan performed songs East Side of Sorrow, 5th of May, Over Time, Burn, 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 Hey Driver, and Heading South. It's the latter that prompted Bryan to tell the crowd how the song changed his life. Quote, I'm just surprised it changed my life forever, he said, adding thank you guys in Des Moines, Iowa for making our dreams come true. Bryan, who headlined at the Hinterland Musical Festival last year, performed in Iowa as part of the Quittin' Time Tour. Here are three memorable moments from the night in case you missed the show or want to relive it. Caitlin Clark collects another shout-out, this time from Zach Bryan. Caitlin Clark, the number one pick in the WNBA draft and the face of the college basketball, once again was given some attention during the Wells Fargo show, arena concert. This is one's for Caitlin Clark, Bryan called out before launching into Revival as part of the encore performance. Lil Wayne called the athlete dope at his Wells Fargo Arena concert earlier in April, and country star Tim McGraw wore a Clark jersey during his concert at the arena in March. You guys got me? Zach Bryan offers storytelling and lots of singing at concert. That's what Bryan asked the crowd several times throughout the night, prompting his fans to sing especially loud and clear during songs. Dawn's and I Remember Everything, the latter of which featured Casey Musgraves and went number one on Billboard's Hot 100 chart. There's no Quittin' Time at a Zach Bryan concert. Bryan and the band excited after Quittin' Time, the last song of the night, before the encore, but the audience wasn't ready to let go. The country musician be finished for the night, and it was clear that he wasn't done either. And who opened for Zach Bryan at Wells Fargo Arena? Opening for the Bryan was Levy Turner, the country singer signed to Bryan's label, Imprint. That brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Nicholas Herter, and my partner at the microphone has been Bobby Bailey. Earlier, you heard Dave Stutz and Lisa Horsch. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.